You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Marcy?
Hey there.
How you doing?
Doing all right.
Busy days for you. I mean, let me introduce us in case there's anyone who needs to be introduced to you. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Marcy Wheeler, a.k.a. Empty Wheel. That's your Twitter handle and the name. I think it's the name of your blog, right?
It's the name of everything, yeah.
Name of everything associated with you. You are famously conversant in the Mueller investigation. You've written a lot about it for various publications, and you write a lot on your blog. And you have experience yourself in relevant things, right?
You could say that, yeah.
Yeah. In what form? Do you want to?
Nope, not there yet.
You don't want to briefly do an episode of This Is Your Life?
Not yet. No, thanks.
Okay. So, last week was a big week in the Mueller investigation, at least in terms of number of documents filed. And I thought it'd be a good time to catch up with you and let you explain to me where we stand now. Now, I think of this whole thing as having at least four baskets by now. There's kind of the original thing, the collusion, or to put it in more properly legal terminology, I guess, conspiracy between Russia and the Trump campaign in the context of influencing the campaign. Then there's obstruction of justice, which I guess goes back to like Trump firing Comey and a whole bunch of other things. Then there's the campaign finance law. That's the thing that's, I guess, closest to being nailed down. I mean, the hush money payments, apparently Trump directed Michael Cohen to make these payments, and apparently they violated campaign laws. I guess there's some – it gets complicated as to whether Trump himself committed a felony. It has to do with how much he was – his state of mind, which, of course, is an ongoing puzzle. And then there's the whole – his whole – private finances, the Trump organization, and so on. There's a fair amount of evidence that in the course of his whole life, he's done things that were illegal. I mean, income tax evasion, probably money laundering. That's not to say these things are necessarily relevant to the Mueller inquiry, although you do start seeing intersections when you get into the question of, you know, Michael Cohen approaching the Russians on Trump's behalf about building Trump Tower, and that conversation extending well into the presidential campaign and so on. But anyway, I guess I see those as some of the major baskets. Would you say I'm correct in inferring that after the documents, a number of documents were released last week, either from Mueller or from the New York prosecutors, that for people who had been hoping to see stuff in the conspiracy collusion basket, was it a disappointing week?
No, it's a week where Mueller said he's still protecting the investigation, but what we got was pretty damning.
Okay, and what was that in that basket?
Well, so we got three documents that go in that basket. We got Mike Flynn's sentencing memo. So he's about to be sentenced to no jail time. He's going to go on, you know, to be a felon and live happily ever after. Michael Cohen had two sentencing documents submitted last week, one from, as you said, Southern District of New York, so New York federal prosecutors. There's also, of course, another basket, which is investigations that the state of New York is conducting. One we know is into his foundation, where he broke all the laws there as well. There would be some interesting other investigations that might live in New York State into, as you said, the general money laundering that Trump organization engages in. So in any case, two filings for Cohen last week, New York federal prosecutors and Mueller. The Mueller one does hit on what you call collusion, conspiracy, Russia. And then finally, there was a filing, for Paul Manafort laying out some of the lies he told over the course of the, basically 2 months that he was supposed to be cooperating under a plea agreement. And so in those, we got different kinds of information in those three documents. The most sensational is Michael Cohen. He pled guilty in sort of tactically interesting federal one charge, one count of false statements the week before. So basically right before he's sentenced, Mueller rolls out one count accusing him of false statements. He pleads guilty to it. And that's sensational. That says, you know, a lot of what we've been telling you about this Trump Tower deal with Moscow, we've been lying about. And I've lied to Congress and gotten other people to lie to Congress, probably gotten Trump Organization to withhold documents to sustain my lies. And I lied, Cohen said, both 2 weeks ago and prosecutor said last week.
And just to flesh that out, the upshot of the lies had been that there were no further conversations after January of 2016 or so with the Russians about building Trump Tower. The truth seems to be that well into the summer, he was communicating with a representative of the Putin administration, an assistant to Putin's spokesman or something. They were planning to arrange an actual meeting by Trump to go to Moscow and I guess meet with Putin. And in their minds, although this might well have not been public, that was connected to the idea of building this Trump Tower and so on. And I guess the meeting was only abandoned. The timing suggests that maybe the meeting was abandoned once it became public via the Washington Post that Russia had hacked emails. Is all of that more or less right?
Yeah. So let me go back and talk about the main lies. One lie, Cohen had wanted people to believe that plan, was over by the time of the first primaries. And in fact, as you said, we know they went through June at least. But even there, Mueller is kind of hiding his cards because Felix Sater has said that it went through July. We're going to find out it went longer than that. We're going to find out that it kind of morphed such that George Papadopoulos was supposed to have a role in it. So it morphed. It didn't.
Now when you say we're going to find that out, that's on the basis of reporting you've done and or information you've acquired. That's
no,
not
that's public. Papadopoulos has said that. Papadopoulos, even in his own sentencing memo, said, I thought the FBI wanted to find out about the Sergey Millian guy. And so I told them, but I kind of wanted to keep it on the low down because I was hoping to get a job. And we know that that job was tied to a big deal with Sergey Millian, partly to build Trump Tower. So it continued all the way through the inauguration.
So does that mean that, okay, the meeting, plans for the meeting between Trump and Putin were abandoned in the summer, but discussions about the tower continued? Is that what the deal is?
Remember, I mean, one of the first things Trump did after he got in office was get Putin on the phone. That's one of the things that Mike Flynn didn't get fired for. Like, he should have been fired on January 26th and stayed around for a conversation with Vladimir Putin on, I forget whether it was 27th or 28th. They continued to work. And when Rudy Giuliani, after Michael Cohen pled guilty, he went to the press and he said, as far as the president knows, the deal never happened. And that isn't, I mean, Rudy Giuliani is a terrible defense attorney, but that is an unbelievably hedged statement for what should be a categorical denial. What Rudy Giuliani is saying is not that the deal didn't continue and isn't in place and isn't being planned right now. What he said was the president has no knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, the president pretends that he has no tie to Trump Organization anymore. So let me go back and go through the lies. One is the plans ended before the primaries. No, they continued at least through June. Like I said, I expect we're going to find out that they continued further. Michael Cohen originally said he only talked to Trump about it three times. Those times were all in 2015. He now admits that he continued to talk to Trump about it. This is really important. And the family. So we know that he continued to talk to Trump about it through basically June. And we know, again, from reporting that has confirmed this, but also because it's obvious because of where he was in Trump org, we know that Don Jr. knew about this deal.
Okay.
So we know, also Cohen said, well, Dmitry Peskov never returned my call. And as you said, Dmitry Peskov, who, by the way, in 2013, when Trump was about to meet Putin when he was in Moscow for Miss Universe, Dmitry Peskov was the go-between to set up that meeting with Putin. So the Trump people knew that Dmitry Peskov was, in fact, the guy that you go through to set up a meeting with Vladimir Putin. And so Cohen lied and said, you know, I only called up Dmitry Peskov's press line, which Peskov backed, by the way. So Peskov was at least endorsing, if not in on the loop, with Cohen's cover story. And in fact, this is one of the most tantalizing thing in Cohen's plea deal, is he had an extended conversation with the assistant to Dmitry Peskov, and she took notes. So we don't know how Mueller knows about those notes, but we know that Mueller knows those notes exist and may have a copy of those notes. So may have some understanding of what Dmitry Peskov understands about that. Okay. But anyway, the whole point is, as you said, the plea deal and the sentencing memo make it clear that Felix Sater and Michael Cohen remain in pursuing this deal through June, and Don Jr. on June 3rd of 2016 is offered a meeting and dirt that is part of the Russian government's more general support for your father. And we know from SJC testimony.
That's the famous Trump Tower meeting you're talking about?
Yeah. So there's dirt that's offered, but Rob Goldstone, when he sends an email offering that meeting, says this is part of the larger package, basically. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but and we know that when, Rob Goldstone was instructed to write that letter, that email.
Yeah.
Emin Agalarov, who's, you know, the rock star paid by his billionaire father to be a rock star, says to him, tell Don Jr. that this is to benefit the Trumps. He doesn't say this is to benefit the campaign. He says it's to benefit the Trumps.
And why is that important?
Well, because we know now that Don Jr. would have known that, they wanted to score a meeting with Vladimir Putin, because they're not going to get the Trump Tower deal unless they get a meeting with Vladimir Putin. So we know there are like 8 offers by this point. You know, George Papadopoulos is one of them, saying, oh, I'll set up a meeting with Vladimir Putin. I'll set up a meeting with Vladimir Putin. And all this time we've been saying, well, who cares, right? But now we know that everyone in the Trump orbit, Donald Trump, Don Jr., Michael Cohen, at a minimum, they all believed that meeting with Vladimir Putin was going to make them a deal, was going to lead them to a deal that was going to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Okay. So now the question is, what would be or could be damning about this? Trump's line, and this is actually maybe is pretty plausible of the way he's thinking about it, is, hey, I figured I might lose. I'm continuing to pursue my business interests. And what's wrong with that? And it's certainly, I assume it is in fact true that there's a difference between being a candidate and doing stuff like this and being an elected president or an actually acting president after inauguration and doing stuff like this. I assume there are legal distinctions along the way, but broadly speaking, and of course, well, what do you think is most, if there is something damning about this, if this is involved in something damning, this whole set of business, kind of discussions, what do you think it's most likely to be?
Well, so we used to think that email, and there are plenty of lawyers on both sides of the fence, former prosecutors, former defense attorneys on both sides of the law, who will look at that email that Rob Goldstone sent to Don Jr. and Don Jr.'s response, if it's what you're saying, I love it. And that is the kind of thing the prosecutors use to establish that somebody has entered into a conspiracy. We had thought that the conspiracy was simply, I mean, we already sort of knew where this was going because we'd seen all the evidence, but we had thought that the agreement that Don Jr. entered into on June 3rd, 2016, before the June 9th meeting, we had thought that it was, you'll get dirt on Hillary Clinton in exchange for what these lawyers are going to present to you in this meeting, which ended up being Magnitsky sanctions. So we had thought that the conspiracy was simply you get stolen emails from Hillary Clinton. Remember that we, you know, at least one person in the campaign already knew about those emails. Probably a lot more did.
That was Papadopoulos?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. He claims he doesn't remember telling anybody. He claims he doesn't recall, right?
Yeah. He says that very carefully, by the way.
Yes. Yes. And I would bet that there are solid records that, people in the campaign knew that in accepting dirt, Don Jr. knew that he, or at least Paul Manafort knew that he was accepting stolen emails. But so it used to be stolen emails in exchange for Magnitsky sanctions. Now we know it's stolen emails and hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate in exchange for Magnitsky sanctions. So the quid pro quo becomes far more damning. And, especially when you consider that this is something that I keep harping on and people really need to focus on. We've had 18 months now of discussions about whether Trump can be indicted, right? Can a sitting president be indicted? And people are revisiting that issue now, given that it's clear the fraud he engaged in is tied to his getting elected. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that, you know, he went and robbed a bank. It's that he robbed a bank so he could get elected. And that may change the legal question somewhat. But whether or not Trump can be indicted, Trump Organization can be indicted.
What kind of dog is that?
That's my, she's my terrorist foster dog. That's Junebug. She's a pit mix.
Junebug. I think we've met her before in past.
Yeah, I tweet about her a lot. She's a terrorist. So, I think the mailman's coming and, you know.
I know that sound. Believe me, I've got two dogs. I know the sound of the mailman coming.
Okay, Junebug, that's enough. So now she's going to jump up. She wants to.
That is good. That is great TV. We love that. Ooh, that sounds like a man-eating dog.
She doesn't like the UPS guy. So anyway, so Trump Org can be indicted. And who signed the letter of intent to set up a Trump Tower? Who is going to profit off of the Trump Tower? Who legally was going to profit? Who, by the way, going back to the other bucket on Michael Cohen, who structured the repayments to Michael Cohen for the hush money to Stormy Daniels and Susan McDougal? But Trump Organization. That is the entity that engaged in that conspiracy to defraud the United States is Trump Organization. So in both of those Michael Cohen buckets, you've got Trump's eponymous corporation that has already been named. It was named, I'm going to get this wrong, nine times in the SDNY sentencing memo and eight times in the Mueller sentencing memo. So both sets of those prosecutors are telling you Trump Organization, Trump Organization, Trump Organization, Trump Organization. It's not just that they're coming after Trump. They're coming after his company and his kids, but definitely his company.
So before I ask what exactly that would mean, I gather you are still confident. And I know that when you speak partly on the basis of the public record and in some cases, at least partly on the basis of information that you've gathered that's not public. And I don't know if this is such a case when we talk about Magnitsky, but you still believe that they are going to be able that A, it is the case that there was an explicit quid pro quo and the quid or the quo or something was the relief of the removal of Magnitsky sanctions, the promise to do that once Trump went into office, I guess. And you think that that is the case and that it's going to be showable that there was an explicit deal there?
Yeah, I think the biggest question for me is who Mueller believes he can charge. So it is not illegal for Trump to be pro-Russian. We've said this before. He ran on it. He was explicit about it. You can't indict anybody for pursuing a pro-Russian policy when the president ran on it. You know, the question of whether he removes sanctions is another one because it's certainly within his prerogative, to the extent up until the time Congress says we're going to add sanctions and does that by law, to the extent that they are executive prerogative, he can remove them. That's his job. So the question is, where else, where the conspiracy is illegal? And one of those always has been when you accept something of value from a foreigner, that's illegal. And if you hide that, if you take steps to hide that, like lying, frankly, but if you take steps to hide that from the government and prevent them from making you disclose that, then you're engaged in what's called conspiracy to defraud the United States. I think that Trump Organization's involvement, the yoking of Trump Organization's business interests with campaign benefits is another one they're not only going to get in trouble on, and this is something I love, and this is something that showed up in the New York filing, the New York sentencing memo. In 2011, Michael Cohen started a PAC called Should Trump Run, tied to, by the way, the same sleazy people who set up all of Roger Stone's dark money groups. So Stone's going to come into this. So that's another thing that's happened.
Well, yeah, there are other ways he's entered it lately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Stone's in a good deal of trouble. But anyway, so Cohen sets up this PAC, and the PAC is funded by Trump Organization money. So this is a moment where a corporation dumps a lot of money into a PAC that is hypothetically, you know, an exploratory committee for Trump. And somebody submitted a complaint to the FEC, and the Democrats on the FEC said, all said, this is clearly campaign finance violation. You know, this is clearly a private corporation funding a PAC, which is illegal. And the Republicans, led by the head Republican on the FEC at the time, said, no, not, they did not disagree with the Democrats' argument. They disagreed with the way in which the complaint came in, because the complaint used public reporting to show that it was being funded by Trump Org, and that it was, you know, mm-hmm. that and the FEC commissioner who wrote the opinion that basically resulted in a tie, and therefore that the Trump Organization did not get prosecuted for this, was Don McGahn. So Don McGahn was FEC commissioner, went on to work for the NRCC, and then works for Trump on the campaign where Trump again is yoking Trump Organization interests with campaign finance issues. And so none of the people involved, much less Don McGahn, because he's actually, I mean, that is his expertise. But Michael Cohen can't pretend he doesn't know that mixing corporate interests and campaign interests is illegal, because he got in trouble for it once in 2012. And Trump can't say he doesn't know about it, because he got in trouble for it in 2012. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that's really going to come back to bite them. And SDNY was explicit about it. They're like, you know, he was on notice this was illegal because he got in trouble for it in 2012.
So that speaks to the issue I alluded to, which is whether Trump committed a felony in directing, am I right, that whether Trump committed a felony in directing Cohen to make the hush money payments in a way that technically violated campaign finance laws depends on whether Trump knew it was a violation, and you're saying we can show that he should have.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that it's the New York stuff, but also there will be campaign finance violations and other campaign violations mm-hmm. on the Russia stuff. When you charge conspiracy to defraud the United States, yeah, you got to know that the regulatory body is out there. So yeah, you have to show that Trump and Michael Cohen both knew that the FEC existed, which of course they will mm-hmm. be able to do. But the key issue is not so much, you know, how much money was exchanged, what kind of regulation, what kind of paper should you have reported. The really important thing is the fraud. And so in the New York case, they very clearly lay out that Michael Cohen, for example, set up two shell companies to hide what he was doing. And he set up those shell companies to hide them because it was election season. Michael Cohen, and this is why they got him to plead guilty mm-hmm. in the way they did, and the way they got him to allocute to his guilty plea. When he goes for the Stormy Daniels payment, he goes to Trump Organization after the fact and says, okay, pay me back for this. Trump Organization, including an executive who may or may not be Don Jr., say, okay, here's how we're going to structure it. So this is mm-hmm. structuring again. This is fraud. this is how we're going to structure your payment, and we're going to call it a retainer, a legal retainer, so that after the fact, people can't find out that you bought off these two women.
And does it not help? Does it not help them that they could claim the reason we wanted to conceal the true source of the payment is because it would have been an embarrassment that would have hurt his campaign, not because we knew it was. That doesn't help them. In other words, they say we didn't conceal it because we thought we were breaking the law. We just concealed it because we knew it would be an embarrassment.
Well, no. I mean, the concealing is the important thing. Michael Cohen is on the record and saying that they concealed it for election reasons. They've got emails between him and either David Pecker or the editor of National Enquirer talking about the urgency of doing it because of the timing of the election. Michael Cohen has a recording of Trump. So they've got abundant evidence, emails, recordings, Michael Cohen himself, other witnesses, all saying that the reason this was done in the way it was done this time around was because of the election. Mm. So this is clearly confrontas, right? Yeah. And that's where that case is going. And that's why, you know, talking about whether election violations get charged is beside the point, because it's the fraud to hide it that they're going to get busted for. Mm. And the fraud is very clear. And the fraud, I mean, that's why it is so important that, again, that Michael Cohen created special shell companies for this, and that the repayment was done in financial structuring, right? That's fraud. That's money laundering. So that's where that's going. But I think that the same is true of some of the Russian related stuff. I mean, one of the other things we discovered, and so I'm jumping ahead, but Paul Manafort filing shows all the lies he's told. One of those is that he lied about getting a $125,000 payment, which for him is like chump change, because normally he adds two zeros to everything. But that payment, the New York Times reported, was a payment from Tom Barak's PAC. Sorry, not Tom Barak. What's his first name? In any case, Barak is one of Trump's biggest funders. He has ties to Konstantin Kilimnik, who is the GRU handler for Manafort, arguably.
Right.
He also is the guy who set up a lot of the Middle Eastern slush. So if we find out that Barak was paying for Paul Manafort rather than the campaign paying for Paul Manafort, then you've got another instance of campaign finance problem, because you've got a super PAC that's not legally allowed to coordinate with the campaign actually paying your campaign manager. And again, if Manafort is lying about that and the government maintains that he just lied about it, then you've got more confrontas. You've got more attempt to hide this fact going forward. So that's one example. I think we're going to find, you know, a basket full of these examples where the Trump campaign was violating campaign finance law and has been hiding it, and therefore that, you know, and especially has been, again, yoking Trump organization and Trump campaign in ways that are illegal. And those are all going to be bundled up in one or several confrontas charges. Okay.
I want to get back to the first basket we talked about, but first, what does it mean? What are the consequences of indicting a company, you know, the Trump organization, as opposed to Trump? I mean, do people wind up going to jail if a company is the thing that got indicted?
Well, I'm not an expert on this. I'm really hoping somebody who is writes this up. It's the kind of thing where you could threaten to shut them down and use that as leverage to get Trump to resign. So, you know, like you impeach the president and use that as leverage to get him to resign. We may get to that point more quickly by indicting Trump Organization. But the other thing is, once you open up Trump Organization's books, and this is what would happen, right? I mean, the other thing that happens is you set up like a deferred prosecution agreement. Then somebody basically lives at the corporation and gets to see their books. And we know that everything they open up, they engage in fraud. what their business model is a brand now. It's no longer running the hotels. So they make an agreement with, say, you know, Aras Agalarov to open up a hotel. Agalarov's actually going to own the hotel. They're just going to brand it and sell a certain amount of stuff on the front end using the brand. But they always lie. So the financing on these deals, not always, but there are numerous examples of them where they lie about how many people have bought into this program. And with that, go get more people to invest, and then they go under, and they've done this serially. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that Trump really doesn't want DOJ inside his organization looking at, and that's where we're going to go. I mean, that's one of the things we're going to find, is that that's the kind of business model that the Trump organization engages in.
Okay. So then, the other thing about the Trump, the Moscow deal in your mind is that, plus the offer to help with stolen emails is one side of a deal, where the other side of the deal is Trump says, when I'm president, if I'm, you know, if you do help make me president, bye-bye Magnitsky sanctions. And you still think that's probably going to actually be shown an explicit deal?
Yeah, I do.
Because that seems to me like that's the big enchilada. I mean, it's funny, you know, the people on the Trump side minimize the violation of campaign laws. And I don't know what the deal is on that as a legal matter. But one thing that's true about Trump is he has, you know, so desensitized us to pretty significant wrongdoing, right? It's like with a past president, if you had shown that he paid off a porn star, it would be like end of story. It doesn't even matter if it's illegal. That would be almost ruinous, right?
Right, right.
But because it's Trump, it's like people are like, yeah, but did he kill over a dozen people? You know, it's like the bar is so high now. So what people are focusing on, you know, is what was the original thing? Was there kind of collusion / conspiracy? You think that this will be shown. You are, again, to some extent here, relying on information you personally gathered.
Yeah, but I do think that the public record sustains it. I mean, the other thing that, again, the Manafort documents we saw show that they didn't show it. This is redacted. But some of the things that we know, he was lying about Konstantin Kalimnik. So Rick Gates is on the record saying that Kalimnik used to be a GRU officer. Mm-hmm. The FBI maintains that he maintains ties to GRU. GRU, remember, is the intelligence agency that hacked the DNC. So what is going on is that through the entire time that Paul Manafort worked for Donald Trump, he was reporting back to basically a GRU handler, a guy from the same intelligence agency as had hacked the email.
And this is as late as what period of time?
Well, what's interesting is, most of the lies that, that Mueller accused him of telling while he was supposedly cooperating have to do with Kalimnik. So one of the things that it's fairly likely is redacted in there is that he was reporting back to Kalimnik, and he was, when asked about it, underplaying how often he was doing it and how substantive the reports he was giving about the campaign. But basically what he was doing was, you know, reporting back to his handler and saying, here's what we're doing with the campaign. Here's, you know, like, so that is to say.
And you think he was doing that until he left the campaign?
No, even after. Now, one of the other things that he lied about, and this is where it gets really interesting, is so Manafort gets fired because his ties to these Russian-backed oligarchs in Ukraine are becoming clear. And in the wake of the Hillary emails coming out, Manafort has to quit, and he thinks he's installed Steve Bannon as somebody to keep up the same effort. And immediately after he quits, apparently, Manafort goes on a boat trip with Barack. And there is abundant reason to believe that Kalimnik is on that boat.
Right.
So, you know, he is thrown off of the campaign. And the first thing he does is goes and sets up kind of a plan after the fact, with, again, this guy who might be called his GRU handler. And so, and one of the questions we know that Trump would have asked, sorry, that Mueller would have asked Trump is, did you know that Paul Manafort was asking Russians for help? And I don't think Mueller asked that blindly. I think Mueller has evidence that Paul Manafort, in fact, asked Russians for help. And so with Manafort, and this is why Mueller has been, pursuing Manafort so relentlessly all along. And there's a hearing, Wednesday to figure out what we're going to do with these lies. But not only, does Manafort know probably that, and he's lying about it, that Trump knew about the June 9th meeting in real time. That's one thing that has already been leaked, that Manafort's lawyer told Rudy Giuliani prosecutors were pretty clear about. But we're going to find out that Manafort, like, it closes the circle. So GRU hacks Donald Trump. We've seen that they were hacking in response.
They hacked Donald Trump?
Hacked the DNC.
Okay.
But we continue to get more information. You know, the Roger Stone stuff gets really interesting there.
Right. But, that's one kind of, well, go ahead and finish what you were going to say. Summarize the closing of the circle.
So GRU hacks the Democrats and releases them. We now know, or we have abundant reason to believe, that the guy running the campaign was in touch with the same intelligence agency, the same Russian intelligence agency, either, you know, indirectly, I'm sure. I'm sure that they, you know, laundered it through, but it wasn't, laundering it through Konstantin Kalimnik is not that good of, it's not that good of a job of hiding it. I think one of the things we're also going to learn, a lot of the stuff that Manafort got charged for, so he didn't register under FARA like he was supposed to, and he laundered a bunch of money to hide where he was getting paid. One of the things we're going to learn is that the reason he did that is because it was so important to hide the fact that he was working for the Russians, the fact right. that, you know, basically the campaign was being run by the Russians. So we know now why he went to the great lengths.
When you say the campaign was being run by the Russians, you mean what exactly?
I mean that the campaign manager was reporting back to the two.
Okay. And so one question that arises is like, this suggests the possibility that Manafort was maybe the key communications conduit between the campaign and the Russians, and presumably that's the way you would handle things like the coordination of, information about the emails and so on. Well, I guess I was about to say, but maybe I can now answer my question. I was about to say, if they've got a solid conduit of communications between Manafort and the Russians, why is Roger Stone apparently running around trying to find a way to communicate via Corsi or somebody about the timing of release of emails? And maybe the answer is that at that point the key player isn't the Russians, it's WikiLeaks. Is that the scenario? I mean, at that point the emails are in the hands of WikiLeaks and that's who you need to be talking to? Is that it?
Oh, I think we're gonna find that it's far more damning than that, but I don't know what that story is yet. Just as a quick example, there is again plenty of reason to believe in the public record that Stone and probably Corsi as well learned not just that Podesta's emails were going to come out, but they learned that those emails included something about a relationship Podesta had with a company called Juul Holding. Juul Holding showed up in the Panama Papers earlier in 2016. And for some reason, Steve Bannon, funded by Rebecca Mercer, very early on figured they needed to attack Hillary on her ties to Russia. And they did this even before, they started this project even before John Podesta had been hacked, which I don't understand why they did that, but they did that. And they accelerated it and they brought it out just in the wake of the DNC emails being released in late July. So DNC emails come out and then Steve Bannon and Rebecca Mercer come out with this report saying, It's not Trump who has the sordid ties to Russians. It's John Podesta. Okay. And they use this relationship with Juul Holdings. I am quite confident based on the public record, that Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi learned sometime in August that some of those stolen emails that either already had been or were about to be dealt to WikiLeaks included some documents on Jewel Holding. And the reason I'm confident about it is because on October 6th, so the day before the WikiLeaks emails start dumping, Jerome Corsi writes a piece after having not written about this since that October 1st report from Steve Bannon comes out. Doesn't write about it. Then on October 6th, he says, boy, you know, John Podesta has a really big Jewel Holding problem. Hmm. On October 11th, emails about Jewel Holding come out. On October 13th, Roger Stone writes a thing saying, boy, you know, John Podesta really has a problem with Jewel Holdings. Now, he doesn't link to the emails in question at that point, so it's not actually clear whether he had actually read them. It's almost mm-hmm. as if he had that attack written. And then it's not until October 17th that Jerome Corsi does the work of saying, look at these emails we, oh my gosh, discovered, oh my gosh, just now. And one of the other interesting things is that Jerome Corsi, in 2017, after it was clear that the Senate was going to investigate the Russia stuff, he deleted all of his emails from before October 11th.
Hmm.
So he deleted all of the emails until the day that Jewel Holding emails come out. And then all of a sudden, any conversation about Jewel Holding is okay because, you know, it's not like he had advance warning. But I'm confident, based on just the public record, that when push comes to shove, when we find out some of the stuff having to do with Stone, we're going to learn. And this is probably not the most damning thing that Stone was involved in, but we're going to learn that via some means that is far more embarrassing than, I think it's not Ted Malloch. I think that Mueller ruled out that it was Ted Malloch. Ted Malloch is kind of a far right Brexity type in the UK who's a dual citizen that Trump was going to make ambassador. That was, you know, both Corsi and Stone have, I called it a Matryoshka cover-up, because starting in August of 2016, they started building cover story inside cover story inside cover story inside cover story. Until Jerome Corsi got brought before the grand jury in September into November and lied to the grand jury. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear what they're hiding, but there's something that happened in August of 2016 that is so damning that they've built up, you know, 5-6 layers of cover story.
What kind of thing do you think it is?
I think their source for those John Podesta emails is damning in a way that I don't know how to quantify, but it's damning in a way that is more damning than, you know, like one of the cover stories that Stone has been relying on, which has completely crumbled, is that his source to WikiLeaks was Randy Cretico. It's not Randy Cretico, it's Jerome Corsi. Jerome Corsi was part of this effort run by a guy named Peter Smith, who reached out to
who died inconveniently, right?
Right. But, you know, a lot of his records have been shared with Mueller. And I think that they also knew in advance that Podesta's emails were going to come out. And they reached out to Guccifer 2.0, according to Chuck Johnson, who's this Nazi guy. They were told to reach out to, and this one's one I find really interesting, they were told to reach out to Weave, who's another Nazi, right? Weave lives in Ukraine. So Weave lives where the GRU lives. You know, if they found out from Weave, that's just a hypothetical. That would be really damning because, you know, no one knows who Weave is working for. No one knows who's paying Weave in Bitcoin. But Weave is the kind of guy who wouldn't be surprising if he's hanging out with GRU guys in Ukraine. And so that's a hypothetical. Now, I'm not saying that's what it is, but that is a hypothetical that is consistent with the known facts and would be the kind of thing that you could see Corsi and Stone hiding. Yeah.
Okay. Now leave aside the quid pro quo question and just focusing on the relationship of people in the Trump campaign to the stolen emails, their knowledge about them, what they may have encouraged people to do them, whatever. What kinds of things would be illegal in that realm would be like felonies, just independent of any larger deal with the Russians? I mean, there are just laws about, you know, what you should do if you know a criminal act has taken place, if you know things have been stolen and so on. And what, and I don't know if there are laws about, furthering the, or encouraging the distribution of stolen information. I have no idea, but.
No, and I mean, no. And I mean, you could be charged with a conspiracy. But
just by virtue of knowing about it and not reporting it?
You could be charged with a conspiracy if you kind of solicit a hack. And here's where things get interesting is,
in other words, if you ask them to hack, then that's.
Right. So when Trump says, Russia, if you're listening.
Right.
Right. And remember that indictment said that same day after he said, Russia, if you're listening, go get Hillary's emails. The Russians did. So
the next day they hacked her personal account. Is that?
Yeah, they went after. Yeah, they went after.
They tried.
They did. Yeah. And did not, as far as we know, succeed. But they went after a lot of people close to Hillary, including, you know, people who work for Bill and Hillary as opposed to the campaign that night. But I've been told that there were like a series of attacks. And I think that we'll eventually find that the series of attacks followed key events, some of them tied to WikiLeaks and some of them tied to the Trump campaign. Mm-hmm. One thing that Roger Stone likes to pretend is that when he started talking to Guccifer, who he likes to claim he didn't know was Russian, but he believed was Russian right up until August 1st, and then things changed on a dime. And so there's another thing that will be explained in interesting fashion, I'm sure. But he's wrong. So he says, you know, I didn't speak to Guccifer 2.0 until after all the hacking was done. And here's where, like, Roger Stone is a terrible poker player. For a guy who's been, you know, doing what he's done. Am I allowed to say that R word here?
I'm not sure what it is, but probably.
So he's been rat fucking his entire life. And he is
that the RF word, by the way, in the trade.
Okay. Well, anyway, so he's been doing it his entire life. And like, I figured out the jewel
stuff. Which for our more innocent listeners means like dirty political tricks, right?
Right. Right. So I figured out the jewel stuff based on his claims. I was like, oh, this is where his claims start to fall apart. And I started looking closer. I'm like, oh, yeah. And I knew, and I, you know, like Jerome Corsi testified to the grand jury that, he was asked by Roger Stone to write a cover story in August of 2016. And I said that a long time ago, based on Roger Stone's, the holes in Roger Stone's stories. Mm-hmm. So another thing that Roger Stone is going to be in trouble for is campaign finance. Again, holes in his stories. He attacked me when I said that. But here's the third thing, and this is really telling. So in the GRU indictment, it described in September, and it gets, the GRU indictment is, I love it because all the places where they get vague are things that you know Mueller is going to fill with really juicy details. And one of the things he's really vague about is, in September of 2016, the Russian hackers went after, Hillary's analytics, which were hosted at Amazon World Service. It doesn't say that it's Amazon in the indictment, but I know from reporting that it is. And it gets really vague about the timing of that. That's important because one of the two conversations that Roger Stone had with Guccifer 2.0, one has to do with his initial conversation, and Guccifer refers to stuff posted, and we're, you know, the public record says that that meant to refer to D-Trip emails. It's possible that he had posted some Podesta emails, or he or the Russians or Weave or whoever had posted some Podesta emails, and Stone referred to those, and that's how he got to the Juul emails. But the second conversation he has with Guccifer 2.0 is in September. Mm-hmm. And Guccifer had released a bunch of DCCC, so the Democratic Congressional Committee. He had released a bunch of those documents pertaining to individual congressional races. So, and he released a bunch to a Republican lobbyist in Florida. His site was called Hello Florida. Mm-hmm. And that one got a lot of attention because it actually, I mean, if you can point to who benefited them, who demonstrably benefited from Russian leaks, that's the moment where you can point to it because all of the Republicans running in Florida got to see what the Democrats had on them. Mm-hmm. Guccifer says to Roger Stone what do you think? What do you think of this stuff? This guy that I sent it to, I shared it with Hello Florida, thinks it's, you know, worth $1 million. What do you think? And Stone's response in September of 2016 is, it's pretty typical stuff. So we now, if you look at the DNC is suing all of these people. They're suing the Russians, the Agalarovs, Roger Stone, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange. And in their lawsuit, they provide details that aren't in the GRU indictment. So they provide the details that Mueller has kept hidden. And they it's this huge passage detailing not just how sustained that hacking of their analytics program was, but how sensitive the data is, how the Republicans could use it, how many times the Republicans did it, and how late into September they were hacking it. And they were hacking it until at least September 22nd. Okay. So they were getting the details about how the Democrats thought of their turnout and how they thought of their campaign through most of September. And a significant chunk of that took place after Roger Stone had said, the analytics data that you've given me is not that interesting.
So there was stolen information that was not being publicized, that was being given to the Trump campaign?
We don't know.
But that's your conjecture.
I think it's definitely possible.
And that's a crime in itself, right?
That's a crime in itself. And then you throw in things like, you know, a lot of people have talked about, I've kind of poo-pooed this, but because of, you know, I was led to believe the exposure wasn't as bad as laid out in that DNC, lawsuit. But, if you're getting a month of their analytics, you're getting a lot of snapshots of how the Democrats plan to win in November. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have pointed to a really significant change in the ad buy that the Republicans did in October.
Yes.
If that came downstream from the Russians having shared that data, either via Roger Stone or via directly to Steve Bannon or Rebecca Mercer or Alexander Nix, right? So this is where you get into the questions we've always had about Cambridge Analytica, and they've got close ties to the Russians. So if you somehow stole that data and got it to the people who are making the decisions on the part of the campaign, and oh, by the way, that's another area where there is a campaign finance violation. Cambridge Analytica, by their own telling, worked primarily for the PAC, not for the campaign, but they were also coordinating. And so if you laundered it into the PAC thinking that was arm's distance and the PAC was coordinating with the campaign, then boom, you're back at another con fraud us, but you're also using stolen data to win the election. And for Roger Stone, this is important because, again, he claims, and in his response to this lawsuit, this is another moment where Roger Stone kind of gives away the game. In his response to that lawsuit, he submits a timeline which pretends that all of the hacking ended in March. And he says, well, I talked to Guccifer 2.0, no big deal. You know, nothing, it was all done by the time I spoke to Guccifer 2.0 in August and September. Now we know that not only did the hacking continue after Roger Stone had those conversations with Guccifer 2.0, but they hacked targets that specifically had to do with what Roger Stone was unhappy with in the first dealing. So, you know, Guccifer 2.0 says, what do you think of my analytics? Roger Stone says, not good enough. The Russians go back and get something very, very good.
Wow.
And the question, yeah, if that gets dealt back to the campaign, then you're in really explosive territory. And
in what sense criminally? So in other words, what is the most serious crime you think Roger Stone is going to be indicted for?
Oh God, it's Roger Stone. Don't make me commit.
Well, but I mean, among the things that you're pretty sure are going to happen to Roger Stone, I mean, again, just to kind of try to hone in on what part of this is kind of clearly illegal, especially to the extent that it could implicate other people in the Trump campaign, perhaps. But what kinds of actual crimes?
Well, okay. So I earlier said that some people, and I think a fair number of people, are going to be charged with conspiracy to defraud the United States based on campaign finance charges. I'm pretty confident that Mueller is investigating Roger Stone for that, that there's clear evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was not keeping his dark money groups clean. He was,
but I mean, as far as the emails go, as far as his involvement
there, he would
in the stolen data.
he would be on the hook for conspiracy to commit Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So two separate conspiracies. Each of those come with significant jail time.
And the key would be evidence that he actually induced crimes by saying that's not good enough.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And so that's what has to happen. It's like not enough that you know that the Russians stole these and you know about the crime and don't report it. That's like not enough to get charged with a crime.
No, I don't think so.
But I mean, I'm just wondering what could ultimately be tied to Trump. Maybe another way to ask the question is if we look at this first basket of, you know, conspiracy / collusion, leaving aside the question of whether Trump would actually be indicted or would be called an unindicted co-conspirator or however they chose to handle it, in terms of what is the most serious crime in that basket that you think Trump himself could ultimately, you know, if not actually be charged with, at least there could be evidence clearly pointing to his complicity.
I think it's easier to show him involved in that quid pro quo agreement, because I think that Mueller probably has evidence he knew and approved of that June 9th meeting. He knew and approved of it because he wanted the hundreds of million dollar deal. He wanted a Trump Tower. He wanted, I mean, that goes right to his ego and right to his when he says, well, I didn't know if I had won, he's admitting that he was pursuing that deal and making deals in the same way that they make deals. And he's too dumb to know or too reckless to know that agreeing to make a deal in exchange for policy considerations is a problem. And
so is that a crime even before you are in office?
Yeah, I think once you're a candidate, yeah. And then in the transition, that's when the Mike Flynn issue becomes critical. Because all of the evidence suggests that Trump ordered Mike Flynn to go to Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, and say, hold off on responding to those sanctions. We'll take care of it after we come in office. To be charged with a conspiracy, you don't have to have succeeded in your conspiracy. So a lot of people are like, well, you know, Trump never did get rid of the Magnitsky sanctions. That doesn't matter. So long as he entered into the conspiracy and took certain actions to pursue it, to advance it, and telling Mike Flynn to ask Kislyak to hold off on responding to the sanctions, that's an overt act. That's the kind of thing that gets charged, that gets named in a conspiracy indictment all the time.
So, and by that time, Trump was the president-elect. He wasn't yet president, but he was no longer merely a candidate.
Right. So, so that's,
and so you think
my dog is going to open my door behind me, but, she's showing off for the camera.
We would love to see her.
James, Junebug, Junebug. All right. You can come up. All right. Let's show you.
Oh, I want to pet that dog. Oh man.
She is a terrorist.
Oh, I have a couple of those in
but
different
she's just
senses.
Been encouraged to, oh my goodness gracious.
That's a big
on the camera.
That is a big lovable dog.
Oh my
For goodness. Our podcast listeners, just trust me, your heart would be melting. You want this dog.
Well, she's a foster, so if anybody wants to adopt Junebug, the terrorist foster dog, she is very sweet.
Wait, she's up for adoption?
Yeah, anybody wants to adopt her, I have to give her up.
Oh, you do. So you're a way station. You know, we have a dog that started as a way station. It was like, can you keep this dog for a few days? Oh, sure. 10 years later.
Yeah, that's what Junebug's intent.
I find him in my bed every night.
Yeah, that's Junebug's plan.
Yeah.
That's her plan. Because she's devious that way.
Looks like it may work. So you think there will be evidence, enough evidence of the other side of the deal. The quid for that quo, you know, for the sanctions relief, such that what Flynn did will congratulations, Junebug, on whatever you just did. Enough evidence of the other side of that Flynn's and it's by now clear that he did say, don't worry about the sanctions, we'll deal with that.
Yeah.
That will be damning, that will be shown to be part of a criminal act.
Yeah. I do. Okay. I do. And, the question is who you charge for that. Don Jr. is clearly in that conspiracy. He's clearly a member of that conspiracy. So yeah, it's a question of who gets charged.
Well, also Flynn has cooperated, right? And there's a not bad chance that he and Trump talked about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
So Trump could well be implicated in Flynn's testimony.
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's absolutely implicated in Trump's testimony.
In Flynn's testimony. So, and you're confident of these things. And again, you're not one of these like wacko conspiracy theorists. In fact, I think you may have started off as a little bit of a skeptic. You were certainly reserving judgment.
I had good reason to want to know what I was looking at, and I did. I took a look at a lot of the, and that's the thing is, so my beat kind of is between, InfoSec. So I know enough about reading those reports to understand, you know, how credible they are and what you need to, I've got, you know, I had people telling me stuff pretty early on that was not publicly reported for another year on a lot of these areas. Just on whether the hack happened and, you know, I've got it close enough ties to the Democrats to be able to check some of those details. So, you know, I did start off, I spent 6 months trying to figure out whether this case was right. And, I think the other thing that happens in these discussions is people don't understand how conspiracies work, right? How conspiracies get charged by prosecutors and what you need to charge a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're talking about the president of the United States, so they're gonna be very careful. Like the way that they've gotten Cohen on the record in the New York stuff, they've made very clear that they have multiple witnesses, they have multiple kinds of evidence, they've got, they've got themselves pretty well covered to prove that there was a conspiracy to prevent.
Just out of curiosity, what exactly is Junebug doing at the moment?
Oh, she's playing with beer cans. She got them off the counter and now she's playing hockey.
Okay.
Because it makes a lot of noise.
Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
This is her tactic. The trash can's here out
of her
reach.
Junebug is saying she would like your attention, but maybe I'm wrong.
No. Yeah. If she could reach the trash can, she'd punch it. That's her other way of getting attention. Mm-hmm. Now she's going to open the dishwasher. So that's the thing is, so they've covered themselves. You can see in the New York case that they've got the conspiracy dead to rights, and they've got whatever executive signed off on the structured payment dead to rights, and that might very well be Don Jr. And they've got Trump orgs. They've got them dead to rights on the conspiracy, and they've got Trump implicated in. And I suspect that this Russian thing, because it's going to be far more complex, is going to take a little more doing. But when they're done with it, unless, you know, Mueller gets fired tomorrow, when they're done with it, I think it's going to be far more damning, because there's parts of it that no one is even imagining at this point.
That you have information about.
Yeah.
Now, some people recall, a few months ago, you kind of went public and said, I should tell you, I was dealing with a source, and tell me if I got this wrong, you became convinced that the source was involved in wrongdoing, and you actually took it to the FBI,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that was, and I gather you can't say any more about that, but that was, well, that was a result of the information gathering you were doing as a reporter that leads, partly supports your confidence that some serious stuff is going to come down.
Yeah. But let me put it this way. Even if I'm completely wrong about my source, right? Possible. I know that there are forensics that have not been revealed that tie the hack. Tie the GRU hack to certain other things that went on, which were fairly damning. I know based on the dangles from criminals that I've gotten since then that other parts.
What is a dangle? That's a technical term.
Meaning I've had some criminals have reached out to me, I think, to figure out what I knew. And that they would find it important to reach out to me suggests that the crimes they were involved in are also tied to this. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, there's ties to WikiLeaks and so on and so forth. So, So I don't know what I suspected will turn out to be true or not. What I do know is that to get to that point, I learned of certain things that tie the hack and leak to some other real damage that Russia did to the United States.
That along a dimension we don't know about yet.
Along a dimension no one's really thinking about, yeah. And the question that I don't know is how much these conspirators knew that they were tied together. If the conspirators knew that they were tied together, I mean, let me give you an example of something that I think is really critically important. I did a post not long ago showing that there were like 6 efforts to get Julian Assange a pardon or something.
6 efforts by who?
By a range of people, including Roger Stone. So Roger Stone in January of this year believed he had gotten Julian Assange a pardon. There was an effort for the Russians to sneak him out of the embassy. There was an effort, Dana Rohrabacher tried to pitch Trump on an alternate explanation for the hack and leak, and the idea was that eventually Assange was going to be brought here with immunity to tell them. There was an effort in February of 2017 to say, if you bring Julian Assange and give him immunity to come to the United States, then he won't release these CIA hacking tools that are going to devastate CIA's hacking program. So those are all these efforts. And that one is the one that I think is, in fact, there's a tweet from Assange to Don Jr., where he says, hey, you should make me ambassador to the United States. And he references not just that program, the Vault 7 program, but he references the one time that they released a live malware file. And so that's an area where when people talk about whether Julian Assange is going to get charged, they don't really think about, but there is good reason to at least wonder whether that's one of the quid pro quos, right? Julian Assange releases these files, and if he releases the files, there's an expectation that Trump's going to get him out of the embassy. And so
the Russians wanted him out of the embassy, wanted Trump to give him.
Well,
That's just a separate deal with Assange and WikiLeaks.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that the Russians, when they were pushing Assange to release these files, were promising Assange certain things. And so, you know, it's unclear how those promises were delivered, but I think that Assange had reason to believe if he helped Donald Trump get elected, he would get a get out of the embassy free card. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't gotten it yet.
So that's an example of something that has not, to my knowledge, really been reported or certainly not dwelt on.
No, it hasn't been dwelt on. And I think, you know, when there's that file that suggests Julian Assange has been charged, and because it's in Virginia and not DC, my guess is that one pertains directly to those CIA files that were leaked, mm-hmm. and to how he was involved in those CIA files. My mm-hmm. guess is, my very well-educated guess is that that they're going to charge him. Look, I mean, I think that they can get him beyond the First Amendment concerns on the leak of those files. So that's to my mind is a fairly no-brainer. And I don't say that gleefully. I say that Assange reached a level of desperation about living in the embassy and made some deals that go beyond being a journalist.
And then there are other dimensions as well that we just kind of don't know about, but you think exists along which Russia either exerted or tried to exert a malign influence on the United States. And am I right in thinking that the Trump campaign was in some sense complicit in?
That I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. Like, I don't know how much the Trump campaign knew, but I think that Russia did other damage in conjunction mm-hmm. with this attack, and I think that will become clear.
In terms of the quids and quos, are you among those who don't think that the thing that happened at the convention with the Ukraine item in the platform is very significant? I mean, Trump did, I guess there was an effort to, anyway, some pro Russian influence was exerted on the platform by the Trump forces. I've heard people who are say you should, that's not part of a quid pro quo. Do you have a view on that?
I don't think it's a smoking gun because the policy change was not that. I mean, it wasn't like, it's not like the policy platform said, we're going to get rid of all sanctions and give Ukraine to Russia. That would be the smoking gun. I think the policy, the, what happened with the policy was a lot more moderate than that. And so I think it is.
It was, but it was in the direction. I thought it was about providing weapons to.
Right. The woman wanted to provide weapons. And that's the, that's how they were going to change the platform. And somebody intervened to prevent that from happening.
Right.
So the policy as it existed is no different from what Obama's policy is. And that's a complaint that I, that Republicans, I think, rightly raise, which is that it's not like the end result of that policy was something radically pro-Russian. What
right,
it did was prevent the Republicans from taking a very anti-Russian stance.
Yeah, still it's something Putin would have been happy about, but okay. So, I mean, it's interesting. I think there was a sense among some people who had been awaiting Friday's documents release with eager anticipation that it had been a little bit of a disappointment, especially as pertains to this first basket I talked about, conspiracy slash collusion, quid pro quo, stolen emails, and so on. I seem to be hearing from you that to the trained eye, no, it's full speed ahead, kind of. I mean, in other words, when you look at, when you take into account the amount that is redacted, the amount that Mueller is just choosing not to reveal, and little things you learned, maybe about when people kept, how late people were lying and various little things, your confidence in your original suspicion that there really is a there, and I gather of, well, but there's a big there. Your confidence is undiminished.
No, it's undiminished. And I will say some of the things that I think is that are delaying the reveal. I mean, everyone expects like, oh, we'll see, you know, Roger Stone indicted tomorrow and then everything will become clear. I think one of Roger Stone's aides is still challenging a subpoena. We're expecting that decision. Maybe it's come on while we've been on, you know, we expect that decision anytime. So you need to finish the Roger Stone stuff. I suspect that a lot of this can't be revealed until Julian Assange is in custody. Mm-hmm. And so, and frankly, a lot of the maneuvering to get him into custody is pretty sordid. I don't take pleasure in that. I think it's, you know, that there are these big deals about, debt relief for Ecuador in exchange for Julian Assange. That's sordid. But I do think from a prosecutorial standpoint, they aren't going to take certain steps until Julian Assange is in custody. There's another mystery appellant who has a hearing on December 18th.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are three dates that are coming up that we know may be holding up any further reveals, right? And I
September 18th or?
Sorry, December 18th.
Okay.
So December 18th is when the mystery appellant has his hearing. Mm-hmm. Julian Assange could be booted from the embassy any day. Like the Ecuadorians are taking huge steps to make that happen, and real steps. Like I said, that negotiation is pretty sorted. They've already said, you know, we're happy. We think that the conditions are sufficient such that you can be booted from the embassy, and we don't think anything that we're unhappy with will happen. So they're already ready to get rid of him. They've given a set of kind of lines in the sand that as soon as he crosses, he'll get booted. So that's in process. And then, like I said, there's one more Roger Stone aide that he will need to testify. I heard recently about another witness that is kind of, that my guess is tangential to that. And I don't know whether Mueller needs to hold on that stuff before revealing, you know, the key players. But I do think people don't appreciate how interlocked these are, and therefore how Mueller needs to do a big reveal. a guess. This is my guess. It needs to do a big reveal at once rather than, you know, indicting Roger Stone and then indicting Don Jr. and indicting. I think that's sort of what's going to happen.
And so how soon do you think the big reveals could come?
I don't know. I mean, it could be December 18th, depending on what happens
really?
In the hearing.
That soon.
It could be not until Democrats have a gavel, right? So either of those.
You mean Mueller might wait until they have a gavel, or the gavel
might,
would
yeah,
reveal?
He might, yeah.
Yeah. And you think the big reveal will shake the presidency? I mean, not that you're a political analyst, but you think it will reach, so leaving aside the question of how much of a smoking gun is found in Trump's hands, you think either one will be found, or it will reach so deeply into the campaign that it will be a profound political problem for Trump?
Yeah, I mean, look, already he can't get people to work for him, right? His chief of staff, whoever's going to replace John Kelly, is going to be a far less effective player. And that is going to have impacts for the Republicans, because Trump has already said, I'm going to hire somebody for politics, not to do legislation, which means after getting shellacked in the last election, Republicans are being told, I'm going to hang you out to dry because I'm going to defend myself. So that's one thing Trump has said. I've already seen Republicans saying, gosh, this, even the Stormy Daniels thing has them rethinking, but also the Michael Cohen thing. They're like, gosh, you know, we've been saying there's no collusion. It actually looks like there might be. And so you're beginning to see, some Republicans want to distance themselves. Again, the shellacking at the election, I think, will make that more convincing for them. You're seeing policy things like his trade war is doing crazy things to the market. Republicans hate that, right? The debt, Republicans claim to hate that. So all of those factors, I think, will make Republicans less willing to put up with Trump, even assuming none of the kind of smoking gun that I believe may come. Like, I think that it is possible Mueller will deliver evidence that Trump acceded to very grave damage to the United States because he didn't care. He didn't think it was really going to happen.
Meaning the sanctions relief stuff?
No, more than that.
More than that?
Yeah. So that's one thing. But I also think that, and this is something I keep emphasizing, Trump can't be indicted. Maybe he can be, but Trump organization can be. And so if I'm a prosecutor, I'm going to go after his eponymous corporation where his ego is invested. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go after that hard because it makes him vulnerable in a way that Nixon wasn't. Right. I did a post on this, and I think in some ways it makes the whole calculation more problematic because Trump, you know, Nixon could save his natural person by resigning. Trump may not be able to save his corporate person at all at this point, you know, because also it's a house of cards and it could crumble anyway because it's under a tremendous amount of debt. So here's the thing is if prosecutors go after Trump org, what does Trump do? And I don't know the answer to that. Does he resign to try and save his company? I don't know the answer to that, but those are some of the things that I think are at play. And so it's,
what would save his company would be some kind of, would it be a plea deal or what? I mean, how would resigning for the presidency help save his company?
It might be if you resign, we'll give you a deferred prosecution agreement for Trump Organization.
That would be an unorthodox deal, right? For a prosecutor.
No, not actually, because if you have a public integrity investigation, DOJ policy says you can shut down an investigation if they resign from the position and resign, take themselves out of the position where they can profit from being in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would be that writ large. You resign from the presidency that you got by engaging in fraud and you forego any benefit that Trump Organization wanted by resigning. And that would happen. I mean, the Russians would have banned Trump, you know, immediately.
Yeah. You know, to me, the clearest evidence that there's something much more, or at least pretty suggestive evidence that there's something much more like a smoking gun than we've seen is the way Trump was behaving on the morning that these documents were going to come out. He was freaking out. You know, he was trying to do preemptive tweeting clearly there was something he thought he needed to discredit coming down. It turned out Mueller chose not to reveal all that much. Don't you think it's clear Trump thought more was going to be revealed than was revealed?
Yeah, I think he thought Mueller was going to deliver the evidence that he knew about the June 9th meeting ahead of time. I think Mueller has it. I think Trump assumed it was coming out in Friday's documents.
Okay. Well, this is fascinating. And, you know, there could be whole other dimensions. Like on this Turkey thing, I wouldn't be at all. So we know that Michael Flynn was like dreaming up crazy ways to deliver Gulen to the to Erdogan. Like, it wouldn't surprise me at all if, you know, after the election, Flynn said to Trump, you know, the Turks want this. And Trump said, well, if they can put $25 million in a bank account of mine in a way that nobody knows, we can arrange this. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Right.
No, I mean, and I do think Turkey is another part of that. I think parts of Flynn's cooperation addendum, it's unclear which or if all Turkey investigations that are going on are what he cooperated on. But I think most people believe that the criminal investigation, which he was a significant cooperator on, is one of, if not several of, the Turkey investigations that the DOJ has ongoing. So Turkey is clearly a part, and there's reason to believe that the Russians have a tie to the Turkey side sooner rather than later, before the election. And then don't forget that the cutout was going to go through the Saudis, the Israelis, the Emirates, through
the
Barak.
You mean if Flynn magically delivered Gulen, it was going to go through them, or what?
No. But some of the cutouts to Russia, the back channel to Russia was going to go through these other Middle Eastern countries. And Barak was the one orchestrating that.
I didn't know that. So you mean they were originally going to be conduits for what exactly?
For funding to Trump.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
From the Russians to Trump?
This is where things get complex. And this is where I speculated the other day that one of Mueller's prosecutors, we haven't seen what she's doing at all. She's an Arabic speaker. She's an expert at kind of overseas prosecution. So she's got the perfect skill set to handle this Middle Eastern graft part. We haven't seen any of it, but we know that Barak was in the middle of it. And so it's my guess that that's another huge shoe to drop, that like Erin Benko has been doing really great work. She's now at Daily Beast on the Seychelles meeting. So that's something that
she's
as good a handle on as anybody, but it's all part of it.
There's so much stuff. Okay. Well, thank you, Marcy. As always, this is incredibly illuminating. You are the go-to person, for credible yet, alluring, commentary and highly informed commentary about the, Mueller investigation. So people, should follow you on Twitter, Empty Wheel. And, conveniently, that's the name of your blog as well. And I hope you'll have time to check back in down the road as more shoes drop.
Absolutely. Take care.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Marcy. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.